Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 358. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with you today. We have one of our regulars, Jim Cassidy, who is the organizing pastor at South Austin OPC there in Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to talk to you this morning.
As always, good to be here, Camden.
We have a really fun episode this morning, and we're really excited to speak this morning with James W. Scott. Jim Scott, who is the publications coordinator for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, specifically for the Committee on Christian Education. Welcome to the program, Jim. It's great to talk to you today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Jim has written two articles that were recently published in the Westminster Theological Journal, volume 74. Back in 2012, you can find the first one, which was written, Machen's Lost Work on the Presbyterian Conflict, Part 1, The Historical Evidence, and then Part 2 came out in the issue following, which looks at the literary evidence. We're going to talk about J. Gresham Machen, we're going to talk about Edwin Ryan, we're going to talk about supposedly Ryan's book, The Presbyterian Conflict, and a whole host of historical issues surrounding that book, or whether or not Machen indeed wrote a book on the Presbyterian conflict, and whether or not Edwin Ryan used that in the creation of the book that is published under his name. So it's a kind of an interesting unfolding narrative and story that we're going to open up today as we look at these two articles from the Westminster Theological Journal. But before we do mention them, I should say that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. I really encourage you this time of year especially to visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. We just had our Reformed Forum Theology Conference, and it was a wonderful time. But it was kind of a loss leader for us, so we really encourage you to visit us online so that we're able to continue doing what we love to do and replenish some of our funds so that we can get into some new projects, including Reformed Academy and maybe some even future events we would like to do next year. But we really need your help. I'm not just saying that in vain. Please visit us today at reformforum.org/donate. We want to thank everybody for their support of what we do here at Christ the Center and our organization, Reformed Forum. Now, Jim Cassidy, I should ask, what did you think when you first saw these in the journal?
Yeah, it was it was kind of one of those moments where you go, well, it's about time.
Yeah.
It's just it was really exciting. So the thing that really wasn't fair was that at the end of part one, you were kind of left with a cliffhanger because you're reading all this evidence and you're starting to see the theory and the thesis developed and proven and supported, and then you get, well, now for I believe the first was kind of the external circumstantial evidence, and then the second article was the internal documentary type of evidence, and so you're just like, oh, I got to wait another 6 months before the second article comes out. You got to be kidding me. So when it finally came out, I grabbed it. It was the first article I read.
Oh, sure.
While I was working on this, the journal instituted a policy of length of articles. And this, I had actually submitted it as one article, but it was way too long for their new policy. So I suggested dividing it up into two. And that's why it came out that way.
Well, it worked out well. I know Carolyn Weirstra also has a book on, or a lengthy article on the OPC history with the Peniel Conference. I wonder if the same thing happened with her. But yeah, the first part here was roughly 40 pages, just the first part.
Even that's too long.
Yeah. However, it nonetheless is all entirely interesting, and as it documents in great detail the correspondence between Machen and several others, and this story. Could you, Jim, get our people up to speed? What is the general course of events here? What was Machen up to nearing the end of his life, and why has this particular issue become such a controversy?
As you know, Machen was very much involved in the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, and also first Princeton and then Westminster Seminaries, and all the issues involving liberalism and eventually the two institutions being the newest, new ones being established. But this basically came to an end when Machen was suspended and the suspension was upheld at the 1936 General Assembly of the PCUSA, which finished up at the beginning of June 1936. And then within 2 weeks, the Presbyterian Church of America, which is now the OPC, was established. And so we get to the middle of June, and all the issues had basically been settled, and it was summer, and this is the time when professors would do a lot of their writing. Mm-hmm. And so he basically had until the 1st of October to work on something. And the question is, well, what was he writing? There's clear evidence that he was writing something, but there's no, hard evidence mm-hmm. in terms of a manuscript or book or anything or notes.
Nothing was found, and then
he in October the seminary classes began again, and then November there was the second General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church of America, and then he was busy with other things, working on another book, and then he died suddenly of pneumonia January 1st, 1937. Mm-hmm. And there are snippets of evidence which have been discovered over the decades since then, suggesting he was working on a book on the Presbyterian conflict of the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence in Machen's papers to substantiate that.
And we should say that all of his records, his archives are they now stored with the OPC? They formerly were with the Westminster Library. Is that the case?
The Machen papers are all in the custody of the Westminster Theological Seminary.
Yes.
Not the OPC archives.
I see. Yeah, I knew they were down there. I didn't know if they had been moved at some point, but that's helpful. So what got you interested in this project, and why did you start to look into studying this particular issue of what Machen was writing there toward the end of his life?
I was working, and still am working, in the OPC offices, and Don Duff was the stated clerk of the General Assembly for quite a number of years. And he and I would talk often about many things, and occasionally, maybe two or three times over a 10 or 15 year period, this whole matter came up. Mm. And I don't remember the context, but it was very intriguing to me. And I thought, this would be something that I would enjoy looking into, mm-hmm. just because it's a mystery. And also, I have a great deal of respect for Machen. And if I could right or wrong, let's say, involving him, I thought that would be worth my efforts.
Yeah, certainly. It's certainly an interesting hypothesis, and no doubt Don Duff would be aware of it, but also other people have mentioned some of these things. But to this point, there hasn't actually been any collection of evidence or indication that Machen was indeed writing a book on the conflict, and it has perhaps been used by someone else. Over the years, how did this develop? Did it just go unnoticed for many decades? And how did this become part of the lore of OPC history, although it wasn't documented in any way?
Well, I think you have to give all the credit to Charlie Dennison, who mm-hmm. was the historian of the OPC. Without him, I don't think any of this would ever have come to light. He, as historian, or even before he was historian, actually even back to when he was a seminary student, would talk with all the, the founding fathers that were still alive of the OPC and the seminary, and learn all he could about things, talking with Paul Woolley, others. One of them was Everett Duvaldi. And I think it was in talking with Duvaldi that he first got an inkling that Machen was writing something during those final months of his life. And that planted the suspicion in his mind that something happened, because just a few years after Machen died, this book came out, written by Edwin Ryan, with actually the very same title, The Presbyterian Conflict. And was there, could there be a connection between those two things?
Certainly.
Mm. And then at some point after that, he began to find some documentary evidence that would support this. But by this time, this would be during the 90s, particularly the late 90s, he came down with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That's Charlie Dennison. And if he had not had cancer, probably he would have investigated this more himself. But then he died in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, there was really wasn't anybody to follow up on all the various leads.
It's quite the mystery. It's quite an unfolding tale, and I must say the way you've written it in the journal is really fascinating on how it unfolds and the evidence starts to pile up. I think this might be the closest thing that we get to some sort of a mystery novel in the theological world. but it's a wonderful a tale, and I'm excited to share this with the listeners. Now, you mentioned Everett DeVeldy and Edwin Ryan. And what were their, who were they, and what were their relationship, what was their relationship to J. Gresham Machen back in the 30s?
Well, Edwin Ryan was Machen's right-hand man in 1936. He was probably the closest person to Machen, both, well, professionally at least. He was also a personal friend. He was the first general secretary for the Committee on Home Missions, 1936 to 37. And that brought him into connection with Everett DeVeldy, who was seeking to plant a church in Cincinnati, Ohio. And so they had quite a bit of correspondence back and forth about planting the church there, also establishing the Presbytery of Ohio in 1936. Now, as far as Machen, Everett DeVeldy was a student of Machen, first at Princeton, then at Westminster. He was very, very interested in Machen's books. He had autographed copies, and he was always praising Machen for his books and showing interest in what was coming out and things of that sort. And that's how I think he learned what Machen was working on, by just asking Machen, what's the next book coming out?
Mm-hmm. And this is before the internet, obviously, so you would have wanted to pump the people for information on future publications, and you certainly was interested. Now, were they students of Machen as well, and did they have other relationships with him outside of the OPC? Were they involved with the Westminster Seminary at all?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Ryan was a student of Machen originally. He had come to Princeton Seminary basically to answer his own personal religious questions. He wanted to find what he thought was the best, strongest defense of Christianity. And so he went to Princeton, and he became, I guess you could say, a disciple of Machen. At that point, he went off to Germany for a year of study with a fellowship from Princeton. Came back. He was an assistant pastor of a Presbyterian church in Westfield, I think it was, New Jersey. And while he was there, his fundraising talents appeared. He convinced two of the people in that church to donate $1,000.
Oh, my.
Westminster Seminary each, which in those days was a very large sum. And the seminary, of course, was strapped for money, and this was quickly noticed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was then hired by the seminary as their field representative, which is to say a fundraiser. And so he served in that capacity for the seminary. But he did other things. He was student named to the board of trustees, the seminary. Machen had a weekly radio program, which Ryan organized as well.
Now, the practices of Machen when it came to writing, as you're building your case here, there's some relevant information about, you know, when he wrote, where he wrote, clerical assistance, things like that. Could you talk a little bit about how that plays into the whole story?
Well, the seminary originally was housed in a converted private dwelling on Pine Street in Philadelphia. And there was no room there for any offices. So Machen's work was done in his residence, which is in a Chancellor Hall. It was called, it was a sort of a hotel apartment complex up on the 22nd floor. So his desk was there, his books were there, his library, everything. That's where he worked.
When did he write? You mentioned that he would no doubt have been writing in the summertime.
That's right. He had the months of August and September without much else to do. Another thing to remember is that even during when school was in session, that Machen still devoted the early morning hour each day to writing. People have sometimes thought that, oh, he was too busy to work on anything, particularly in the mid-30s there. But the fact of the matter is that he set aside time in the morning. According to Paul Woolley, who knew Machen's activities as well as anybody, they had lunch together, often together, just the two of them, by the way. Woolley wrote that every morning Machen would spend a few hours writing and then walk to the seminary in time for the chapel at 10:30, or if he was just too busy writing to get there for his first class at 11 a.m. So we do know that even when he was busy teaching, that he still devoted 2 or 3 hours every morning to his writing projects.
That's helpful. So it would have been natural that he was writing. He also had some correspondence with the publisher, didn't he? It seemed to indicate that he was working on something, or at least something was going to be published imminently.
Yes, he carried on correspondence with his editor, whose name was Ellen Shippen at Macmillan in New York. And in the spring of 1936, they were discussing his plans for publishing what would become The Christian View of Man, which was basically a series of his radio messages. That had all been written, but he wanted to edit the manuscript, put it into book form. We do know that he didn't actually get to that until November of 36, and actually got it all finished and off to the publisher shortly before he died. But in talking with her, or corresponding with her, I should say, he would speak and she would speak occasionally in the plural of possibilities of manuscripts. And we know of one that I just mentioned, but what was the other one? That's not indicated.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I try to argue is, in the article, is that Machen's correspondence was always saved. You look in his papers that we still have, and you can follow the correspondence back and forth between Machen and various other people.
He'd do this with carbon copies, so either letters he received he would save and file away, or letters he wrote he'd still have a copy of them, right?
That's correct. Hmm. And he employed a professional stenographer who actually would keep his current correspondence. And oftentimes there were places in this correspondence where you would expect something to have been written that would talk about what he was writing. And those letters are all missing, with one exception. The other place where there is a lot of evidence about what's going on here is, you see, Edwin Ryan destroyed all of his papers. Remember that one year he was the General Secretary for the Committee on Home Missions. So his papers in that written in that course in that capacity were kept in the files of the Home Missions Committee, the OPC, not in his own personal collection. So we have in the OPC archives a lot of his correspondence. Now, even there, a lot of some things might be missing, but there's one very short letter he wrote to Everett Develde, which he says, quote, he says, Machen, quote, is very busy. This is in August 26, 1936. Machen is, quote, very busy writing the book on the Presbyterian conflict, unquote. And what I suspect is that Ryan went through his papers and also the Machen papers, all Machen's papers shortly after his death, removing anything that would be indicative of this work, but that he missed this one little letter to Develde.
Right. And so Ryan would have been able to do that because of his access to Machen's house, well, his apartment, and his close involvement with Machen as his assistant and close friend.
You have to understand that Ryan was not just a personal friend of Machen. That is, he would often be, or sometimes at least, would be invited to Machen's house for dinner, just the two of them. But also, he was a friend and confidant of the Machen family, particularly Arthur Machen, who is Gresham Machen's brother, and who was a lawyer and down in Baltimore.
And the eventual executor of his estate.
Of Machen's estate. And there's some evidence that that Arthur Machen employed Ryan to organize Machen's papers and effects.
There's also seemingly some other evidence here. We have some documents from a memorial service that Everett Develde spoke a few days after Machen's passing. We also have some mention of a book on the conflict in Arthur Kuschke's diary. He was a student at the time and had overheard Machen speaking about the book he was writing. Does that seem to corroborate the fact that Machen indeed would have been busy writing that particular book, not just a book, or not just collecting his radio addresses for the publisher out in New York?
Yes, there are basically three documents. First, I've already mentioned the letter from Ryan to Develde of August 26, 1936. Right. The reason he wrote that was he was trying to tell. See, Develde had invited Machen to speak at his church in Cincinnati. Machen had agreed to do that. That correspondence, by the way, is missing. And that's where I suspect Machen may have said something about his writing, his what he was busy doing at the time. But Develde had this brilliant idea that since it was his job to get the Presbytery of Ohio going, that it would be nice if the constituting meeting, if it was held the day after Machen was there speaking in Cincinnati, so that Machen could stay over another day and be present when the Presbytery was established. And so he wanted to invite Machen to do that. But Ryan replied to Develde that he didn't think Machen would want to do that because he was so busy writing this book. So there's very clear evidence there that Machen was, in fact, writing this book on the very subject of the Presbyterian conflict. But then Machen did agree to come out and stay an extra day. And there's actually quite a bit of evidence as to what Machen did on those days. That would be September 13 and 14. And that Machen did, Develde did, in fact, have a lot of opportunities to talk personally with Machen on those occasions. And what it's unimaginable to me that Develde did not talk to Machen about whatever Machen was working on when he was writing. And then that would explain why 2 days after Machen's death, this would be on January 3rd, Develde read a memorial statement in his church which has been preserved, in which he said that Machen had actually finished writing a book which they even had a title for, The Conflict, and that Duvalli was quite sure that it would be published, in his words, shortly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this information could only have come from Machen himself.
Mm-hmm. So the letter from Ryan to Duvalli itself even presupposes some prior knowledge that Duvalli would have had about this writing, because he mentions the book. But then also the personal correspondence between Duvalli and Machen during his time in Cincinnati seems to demand, and given the fact that Duvalli was just fascinated and really wanted to know everything about Machen's writings. And then the memorial service all seems to pile up the fact that Machen had in fact written a book, at least a substantial portion of a book, and it was ready to be published very soon.
Yes. Now, there's one question that arises in all this, and that is, if Machen was writing this book, if Ryan knew about it, Duvalli knew about it, why didn't anybody on the Westminster faculty seem to know anything about it?
Right, right.
And why did any of the students know about it? I mean, why was it just these two guys?
Well, Kushki and some students might have known a little bit at some point.
Yeah, this has always been a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that there is good evidence that there was some knowledge of it. And that is that Arthur Kushki, who was the librarian at Westminster for quite a number of years, was a student, a first-year student at Westminster Seminary in 1936, and he kept a diary. And it turns out that according to his diary, that on the first day of the dining club, which would be October 1st, 1936, that Machen appeared and talked to the students basically about what he'd been doing during the summer, and it's basically his summer vacation, his vacation in July, when he had gone to the Canadian Rockies to do mountain climbing. And he talked about climbing the various mountains and so forth. And then Kushki adds that he spoke about, quote, or at least he mentioned, quote, a book he will write on the church split. Now, it sounds there like maybe he hadn't started writing it yet. But I try to show that probably Kushki misunderstood what Machen had said.
Mm-hmm.
Machen probably had said that while vacationing, he had decided to write this book when he returned. And Kushki didn't understand that he had returned in August and was writing it then, not that he had returned and that he would get to it as soon as he could in October.
So now we have a missing manuscript, a manuscript that seems by the evidence that you propose to have been taken by Edwin Ryan. Is that the type of thing that would be keeping with Edwin Ryan's character?
I think it is. Now, Edwin Ryan renounced Machen and the Machen movement in 1947 and returned to the PCUSA. And because of that, he has been much reviled by people in the Westminster and OPC community. However, I would not use that as evidence that he could have done something like this. I think we have to be careful. His return to the PCUSA was for various other reasons, and they don't necessarily mean that he was, you know, an unethical person. However, in doing my research, I uncovered, I think, about 10 instances. These are documented instances of unethical self-promoting behavior, instances where he would do unethical things to promote what he thought were good causes. And so that it would seem that he would have been willing to do this sort of thing. And this is not just my own own view. You know, the other people who knew him, for example, Paul Woolley, had a very strongly negative view of him as a man, as a Christian, in terms of his ethics and so forth.
Now, you've already mentioned the fact that Ryan was gifted in his promoting abilities, his fundraising abilities, and presumably his networking skills and charisma and all the things that typically go along with those kinds of abilities. Can you speak about Ryan's view for the OPC early on, even before it was called the OPC, when it was the PC of A? Yeah. And how did that eventually pan out and get him involved in just a whole host of other things, particularly universities? But I think it's interesting and indicative to set the stage for what he was, what his vision was early on.
Part of the genius of Machen was that people with various theological emphases could all see themselves in Machen. And he seemed to appeal to people of a wide variety of theological interests. For example, people who are very strongly Reformed, whether of the Scottish or Dutch variety, as well as people who were in the more in the broader American evangelical Presbyterian tradition. So he sort of held everybody together. And Ryan was one of these people who he was more of the American Presbyterian stripe. And so his vision for the church, for the what was then the PCA, was that it would be a large, rather broad, but basically evangelical Presbyterian church. He assumed that when the church was first established in June 1936, that a whole host of conservative churches in the PCUSA would leave that denomination and join the PCA. That never happened for various reasons, primarily, I think, because that would mean a loss of their property, and they didn't see if they could they didn't want to do that.
So it seems as if Ryan himself had some visions of grandeur.
Oh, certainly. He thought this was the beginning of a great new movement. However, very few churches actually joined the Machen's church, shall we say. And the great majority of the ministers were guys just out of seminary who were, you know, very enthusiastic about, you know, being a true Presbyterian church.
Right.
So Ryan was interested in using the PCA, which became the OPC in 1939, sort of to galvanize a larger movement, both within the Reform world and even in evangelicalism more broadly and among the fundamentalist churches, a broad movement, even a broad church eventually, that would uphold the gospel in a general sense, I guess be Presbyterian in a general sense, but not necessarily very strictly Reformed as understood by the Westminster faculty. And so there was a struggle then in the late 30s and early 40s, culminating, I think, in the Clark controversy in the mid-40s, between these two forces, between those that wanted a theologically narrow and strict OPC, led by people like Van Til, Cornelius Van Til, and people like Edwin Ryan, who wanted a broader church. And Ryan did things like the establishment was called the Committee of Nine in the OPC to figure out ways to broaden the appeal of the church and make it more of a force in the general culture. And this was opposed, almost might say subverted, by Cornelius Van Til. And he convinced the General Assembly to squash this. And so that certainly turned off Ryan. But Ryan's next attempt was to establish a Christian university along the line of these general broadly evangelical lines. And so he worked to establish the Christian University Association and starting in 1943. And he became the general secretary of the association in 1944 until he was relieved of his duties in 1946. And his idea there was, again, to have a broadly based evangelical university. Trouble was that the board of this association was controlled by ministers and professors of a more strict.
Mm-hmm. They didn't share his vision.
And so Ryan engaged in various, even underhanded maneuvers to try to broaden this association, which is why he was finally relieved of his duties. But the whole idea of this as a university was a pipe dream. Yeah. He didn't begin to have the resources, particularly financial resources, to do it.
Well, Ryan eventually became vice president or president of several institutions throughout the rest of his life, but I think that issue with the CUA, the Christian University Association, is most indicative, because that, I think, of all the issues that you present in terms of Ryan's character, is the most telling and most egregious. There are many issues in which he seemed to claim credit for himself in naming the OPC, in running Machen's funeral, in puffing himself up, it seems, in the way that it's presented. But this issue with the association is most egregious. You mentioned the fact that they had a board that was not necessarily amenable and on board with Ryan's vision. But this was also an organization where you could serve on the board so long as you subscribe to the theological confession, as well as donate at least $5 a year. Is that correct?
There was a membership, an association membership, where that was true. And there were hundreds and hundreds of members. And in order to become a member, which is basically, understand, this association is basically a donor base.
Mm-hmm.
To be a member, you had to donate $5.
Which is still sizable back then.
That sounds trivial today, but in those days, this was the mid-40s. This was a fairly decent amount of money. And then that would make you a member of the association. And the association had very limited powers, but it would approve board members. It couldn't nominate board members, but it could approve them. And so Ryan tried to use the membership in ways that would go beyond the constitution of the association. And he tried, this is pretty impressive, most telling, he tried to pack this membership with people that he thought would support him. But in doing so, to get around the $5 membership requirement. And the way he did that was through an accounting trick. If people would donate more than $5, he would take that money that was beyond the $5, and he would use that for his for the membership fee, if you want to call it that.
For his sympathizers.
For his friends, yeah, who could get in there basically free then. So there were maybe a couple hundred people like that who didn't donate a penny, but could be accounted as such by this transfer of funds. And this was discovered by the treasurer, who was Leslie Sloat at the time. And this was an obvious ethical lapse. And Sloat and another member of the Presbytery of Philadelphia, I think it was McClelland.
Right.
McClellan.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to bring charges against Ryan.
But they confronted him privately first, right?
Yes,
according to Matthew
18. Yes, they confronted him privately. Mm-hmm. I think it was by phone.
Mm-hmm.
And by a strange coincidence, that very day then he wrote a letter of resignation, renouncing the jurisdiction of the OPC. So he got out of there as fast as he could before charges could be brought against him.
Right. And then what was it, a week later or so that he joined the PCUSA? Or was it a little longer than that?
A little bit later than that.
He
expressed interest in coming. He had to be reordained.
I see.
In the Presbytery of Philadelphia of the PCUSA.
Now, this is probably several years in the making, but this was at least a high motivation to get out at that moment, correct? I mean, he no doubt would have been dissatisfied.
Well, you have to understand a number of things here. First of all, his theological vision or ecclesiastical vision was being denied in the OPC. And also, very importantly, here's a man in his mid-40s who now was without a job. He had quit his job as field representative at the seminary to become the general secretary of the Christian University Association, but he had lost that position. So he didn't have a job. He didn't really have any prospects. He wasn't really the pastoral type. So he didn't really have any prospects in the OPC, so what was he going to do? And then here he was, with these charges looming over him. So you can understand why he would look elsewhere. And it may be also at this time that he claims that the reason he went back was he had been making this big study of ecclesiology and decided that on a high moral grounds and theological principle that it was wrong to Formation and his followers to leave the PCUSA. And
right.
There may be some truth in all that, but...
But the evidence seemingly that he renounces jurisdiction the day of this confrontation.
The theological justification follows ethical necessity.
So let's talk. You have a fascinating theory here about how the manuscript could have gone missing. How would Edwin Ryan have had access to the manuscript, and how is it, do you think, he could have gotten his hands on it to begin with?
Well, as I said, all Machen's papers, anything he was writing, notes, whatever, was all in his apartment. Ryan was very close to Arthur Machen, the executor of Machen's estate. They went out. They were the two guys, along with Arthur Machen's wife, who went out to North Dakota to see Machen when he became ill out there. Now, Machen actually died before they could get there, just by a few minutes. But they rode back together on the train and probably discussed what they were going to do with in this situation. And my suspicion is that an arrangement was made, that Ryan would help out Arthur Machen in working through Machen's papers, through his effects and so forth, that while Arthur Machen was in Baltimore, that Ryan would attend to matters up in Philadelphia, which would probably mean looking through his papers to see what needed to be attended to, either in connection with the seminary or in connection with the church. And he probably asked Ryan to organize things. We do know that Machen's papers soon were moved down to Baltimore, And my guess is that Ryan organized those things.
Sure.
All his books were left to Arthur Machen with the instructions to give whatever he thought would be useful to the seminary, which he did. The seminary was about to move out to its present location in the summer of 37. And so my guess is that they probably stayed in Machen's apartment until they could be moved out.
Mm-hmm.
So Ryan was the one person probably, as far as I know anyway, who was probably given access to Machen's residence, to his papers. And my suspicion is that when he found Machen's manuscript, and maybe probably notes as well, that he thought, oh, something's got to be done with this.
Mm-hmm.
And he may have thought, well, originally he may have thought this needs to be edited and published. And at some point, that, you know, I could rework this and use it to my advantage.
Now, there's quite a bit of external evidence. It is circumstantial, but there's a large list of it, 40 pages that Jim documents in the part one of the article. Well, the first article, which is part one of this overall case. You can read that in the Westminster Theological Journal. But so we've seen the fact that it's known, and certainly documented, that Machen was writing a book, that he was writing one specifically on the Presbyterian conflict, and that he was feverishly working at it, and in fact it was really near to publication, almost ready to be published, and then he passed away. We've also seen Machen's writing habits, and that backs up the fact that this book was ready to go. We've looked closer at Edwin Ryan, and seen that he had some dubious exchanges and a history of some questionable behavior. It would seem to indicate that he in fact was capable of such a thing as we're presenting. And the fact also that he would have had opportunity to look at Machen's manuscript to find it, as well as to expunge any evidence in the correspondence that might have indicated the fact that Machen was or had written this book. But that's all the circumstantial evidence. Let's look now at the literary evidence. Let's look actually at the book that's in question, which is the 1940 publication, The Presbyterian Conflict, published under the name of Edwin Ryan exclusively. What kinds of things might we be able to do by looking at internal evidence? What are some of the procedures we could take, or some of the ways that we could at least open this book and study it internally, now that we've seen all the things pointing at it externally?
Okay, first I'd like to correct one point.
Oh, please.
I think Machen, by the time he died, had nearly completed, not quite completed, but nearly completed a first draft.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he had gotten anywhere beyond that.
So Develdy might have been a little overly optimistic.
Yes.
But there was definitely a substantial portion of the book.
Oh, yes.
That was
it was very substantial. And so I think what Ryan did was he not only augmented the book, Machen's manuscript, but he also revised and edited a little bit, both for just for editing purposes and also to give his own slant to things a bit. And as you look at the book, you see that about a quarter of it was unquestionably written by Ryan. And I say unquestionably because it either relates events that occurred after Machen's death, or it refers to things written after Machen's death. Or, and also in a few cases, it has some very discussion of Machen himself, which is very flattering, that, of course, Machen wouldn't have written. So how do we figure out what Machen maybe had written in the book? And Ryan, how do we do source criticism, you might say?
Right, like JEDP, but here we have M and R.
Of course, we're you know, in our circles, we're very suspicious of that sort of thing, and how sure. can we possibly do that? And with good reason. And there are a number of things I try to do here. And first thing I do is I look for internal evidence of things that would have been written in 1936 rather than 1940, or shortly before that. I could say that there's very definite evidence from a letter that we've uncovered that Ryan did his writing from about August 1938 through January 1940. So he would have started a couple years after Machen had written in August to October 1936. And we don't have to look any farther than the first paragraph of the book. The very first sentence of the book refers to, quote, the theological struggle which has just ended in the PCUSA. Well, that struggle ended in January 1936. Now, that would have been just before Machen was writing, but it would not have been just before Ryan was writing 1938-39.
Yeah, roughly 3 years later.
That's right. It's also inconsistent with the very next sentence, mm-hmm. where there's a little note that the Presbyterian Church of America was, quote, now called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Now, that church was renamed in February 1939 as a result of a lawsuit brought by the PCUSA, which was successful. So that, at the very beginning of the book, you see this inconsistency in this statement, which fits much better with Machen writing in 1936. Another indication, there's a short chapter on various efforts in the PCUSA to unite with other denominations. And those are described as taking place in, quote, the past two decades, unquote. That involves three churches. In two cases, those union discussions went back just into the 30s. But there was one involving the Presbyterian Church in the U.S., which would be the Southern Presbyterian Church, that started in 1917. Now, the past two decades would bring that up to about 1936 or 37. So that would fit Machen writing, but not Ryan about 3 years later. Another indication is the chapter on the decisive 1936 General Assembly of the PCUSA. That is a very emotional chapter in which the author argues the issues involved, but does not really describe what happened very much. Now, that doesn't look like a historian looking back at the situation. That looks like someone who was intimately involved defending his position, which would be, in other words, Machen. Perhaps, to me, the most interesting, although perhaps the most obscure point would be the fact that there is a reference mm-hmm. to the League of Evangelical Students. This is almost like a passing remark, which the author says that there are 58 schools or chapters at various schools mm-hmm. who are members of the League of Evangelical Students. Now, why would anybody say 58?
That's never round.
That's a very exact number. Well, okay, now we know, we can figure out, if we can trace the membership of this league, we can figure out when this was written. And it turns out that the publication put out by this league, which came out three times a year for most years, had on its cover a list of all the member chapters. So I spent quite a bit of time counting them all up, putting all the evidence together, and it turns out that the number of schools increased gradually, and it was actually in late 1936, maybe September, I don't know exactly when, that the number 58 was reached. And by the time that Ryan was writing, 1938 to 40, the membership was about, it was 60, 61 in that range. So it looks like This reference refers to the situation very exactly and very precisely of when Machen was writing.
Right.
Now, I should also point out, Machen was intimately involved with this league. Ryan was not.
So Machen would have known that.
Yes. Now, another interesting thing is that this very short description is a very upbeat account of this league. You know, everything's going great guns. Well, again, that was true in 1936. But the league declined badly and rapidly in the late 30s, 38 to 40. It was almost ready to collapse. And in fact, it just about did in the early 40s. And it joined with another student organization. So this this description of the league and its membership number very precisely fits someone writing in the fall of late summer and fall of 1936. So those are all very interesting. Now, trying to look at the question of what did Ryan write versus Machen, this is how I approached it in terms of source criticism. As I said, there are certain material which Ryan must have written. So what I've done is in my articles, I compare that material with the other material, about three-quarters of the book, which Machen could have written. And when you do that, you find time and time again that the Ryan material looks very much like an interpolation into the surrounding material.
Mm.
Now, if Ryan had written the entire manuscript himself, there wouldn't be this discontinuity right at the time that Machen died.
Right.
It all looks like something added later. Now, it's difficult to explain that right now because it's, you have to really have the whole text in front of you and
Sure. Look
at the exact wording. But let me just give you one example, which I think is pretty clear. In chapter 3, the author says he's going to give, quote, a few facts, unquote, showing that the Princeton Seminary had changed. Well, that's followed by a three-page critique of Bardeenism, which seems sort of bizarre.
Well, and Jim Cassidy here might think that's only a few facts for him. That'll go by so fast.
But then, right after that, the author says that he gives us, quote, another way, unquote, in which the change in Princeton was shown. Now, what is this three-page essay on Bardeenism doing there?
Right.
It doesn't belong in this you know, brief description of a few facts. But what it is, it reflects, it's put in there because one of those facts was that Princeton had just named a Bardeen as their new president. And so Ryan saw this as an opportunity to put in something he had written or had, I guess, on Bardeenism, which showed his theological acumen. As I think we need to understand that Ryan was not really an academic, although he was close to being one, and I think he had aspirations that were unfulfilled in that respect. And this is just one little opportunity to, might say, show off his knowledge of theological matters.
He was more of an academic administrator.
He was an administrator, yes.
And fundraiser.
Administrator, fundraiser. He was in administration, basically, where he did his later. Well,
now, we find a bunch of discrepancies and differences in literary style and many of those discontinuities there that you've already mentioned. All those are documented in the article, of course, part two. But I found also some interesting things here with the footnotes and the way that some of the sources were referenced and the versions of sources that were referenced. What sort of things there arise that seem to indicate there might have been two authors to this work?
Ryan, a few years later, later in the 40s, wrote two books. Not of any great note, but he did write two books. And if you look at the footnotes in those books, They're very careful, very full citations of sources. So that was obviously his preferred style. He was, I must say, a careful, not, you know, he was, he could express himself well, a very careful writer. But then you look at this, Prestery and Conflict, and look at the footnotes there, and the source citations are very sketchy, incomplete, oftentimes. And you think, well, why was this? And what I think happened was that here Machen was very hurriedly, in August and September, October of 1936, writing this manuscript. And he didn't want to take time to write out all these footnotes in great detail and so forth. But so he would just write down sketchy references to them. A couple of times, for example, he just refers to Machen pamphlet. Well, Machen wrote a number of pamphlets. Mm. Now, he would know what he was referring to. But that's not the sort of thing that anybody else would write down, just Machen pamphlet. You would at least give the title of the pamphlet so you'd know which one you're referring to.
Right.
And the fact that there is confusion there is shown by the fact that when the OPC Historians Committee put out a reprint of this book in 1992, they tried to fill out a lot of these footnotes and in a few cases actually put in the incorrect pamphlet.
Oh my.
Wow.
Now when Ryan came along to this, you know, he had two options. He could either fill out these hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, or he could just leave them the way they were, and what he added, he could just add similar sketchy footnotes. And he chose the latter route. And I think the reason was that he was just lazy or too busy or whatever. He wasn't interested in this, that sort of pedantic sort of thing.
Yeah.
Spending all this time on it.
So, Jim, this is quite the expose. Quite a scandalous thing in many ways. Have you gotten any type of pushback or criticism from those who may want to support Edwin Ryan and his character and name?
I have not. However, it may be that no one of that sort has seen it. Has seen my articles.
Now, you mentioned in the 80s that the family did not want the book to be republished. Is that totally incidental, or is it an issue over rights? But it was republished because it had gone out of copyright, correct?
Yeah, the book was in the public domain when it was reissued, almost exactly when it was reprinted.
So should we read into that anything?
The family had become basically moderate or to liberal in their theology. And the book was sort of an embarrassment because Ryan's own views had changed.
I see.
They wanted the book to sort of, they would prefer to have the book forgotten because it represented, let's say, the old, young, foolish Ryan versus the more mature, later Ryan.
Hmm.
I had some correspondence with Ryan's daughters, particularly Abigail Ryan Evans, who was a very interesting woman, still is actually. She was one of the first women students at Princeton. She became a minister in the PCUSA. She taught at Princeton. She was in fact the chairman of the Department of Practical Theology at Princeton.
Oh wow.
She just recently became a professor at the Georgetown University Medical Center. Her specialty is the spiritual care of geriatric patients. I was in contact with her basically to find out if there were any Ryan papers around that I could look at. I didn't tell her for what reason I wanted to see them.
Right. And the Princeton archives are sparse.
I found out from her that they had all been destroyed. There is one small box of material at the Princeton Seminary Library, which I went to and went through, but there's nothing there of that's really very helpful. It's what's there is basically Ryan's own interpretive reflections on his life, not any documents that would show what was going on.
Right, and tapes of him talking about things. And
yes, I did. Yes, there were some tapes that are there also that I listened to. They're in very poor shape, by the way. I had to hold the tape recorder up to my ear just to hear them. Very scratchy. But they're, it's also another interesting source. But again, this is all Ryan interpretation. Pretty short in facts.
Well, it's quite interesting that Princeton Seminary has, I believe, an annual Edwin H. Ryan lecture. still in his name and in his honor.
I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting. After he retired as a president or vice president academic type, he was hired by Princeton to be an assistant to the president. In which capacity he was basically, again, a fundraiser for the institution.
Hmm. I mean, there's so much evidence here, and we've only been able to, share it in a certain way on audio. I do encourage people to take a look at both of these articles in order to get all the details and the way that it unfolds literarily. It's been fascinating. But just for the sake of the listeners, those people who might be driving around or exercising and can you just, offer your conclusion, just your, final few sentence conclusion, given the evidence of what actually happened? Now that you've looked at everything, you looked at external and internal evidence, what seems most plausible in terms of what happened with Machen and Edwin Ryan?
I believe that the evidence is overwhelming that Machen was writing something about the Presbyterian conflict. Most likely, it was, in fact, a nearly complete rough draft of a book. There's no explanation, really, for why this would have disappeared from Machen's papers, other than that someone took it. And the only plausible candidate for that is Edwin Ryan. And the fact that a book on that very same subject appeared just 3 or 4 years later, written by Edwin Ryan, makes it look very much like he was, in fact, the writer. And that, therefore, that there's a plausible case that the book was based on this Machen manuscript. And when we look at the book itself, trying to analyze whether there's evidence of it having a Machen foundation, let's say, there's actually quite a bit of evidence that that's, in fact, the situation.
Hmm. It's a rather compelling case, and once again, a serious issue and certainly a scandalous issue, but it's all documented. If you'd like to read it, you can find part one in the Westminster Theological Journal, volume or issue 74 in 2012 on pages 217 to 255, and part two is in the issue following. So both of these articles are available from the Westminster Theological Journal. You can take a look at them there. But Jim, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for writing this article and doing all of the legwork and the study and the investigation, and then also for speaking with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
We want to point people back to the website. Of course, you can visit the OPC at opc.org, and you can also read New Horizons and other publications that Jim is helpfully assisting and coordinating, and you can find out more information about the Committee on Christian Education online at opc.org. You can also visit us online at reformedforum.org, and there you'll find information about all of our programs as well as upcoming events and other projects that we hope to promote. We do also encourage you to visit our new website, reformed.academy. It's a new open source project. We're trying to promote Christian education and collecting resources and offering a structured way to learn. So visit us online at reformed.academy as well as reformedforum.org. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.